Welcome to Fight Back Radio, the Marxist voice of labor and youth in Canada, and the best source for revolutionary analysis of current events, perspectives, and theory.
If you took this discussion to the United States, most of the left denies the possibility of building a genuine workers' party there. They argue that workers must be practical, that they should join the what the labor leaders say and advocate some form of support for the Democratic Party, which is one of the two major capitalist parties. However, these people, they don't have a correct understanding of the U.S. working class history, nor an understanding of the perspectives for U.S. capitalism and world capitalism. Now, Marx has explained that the working class, if it's not conscious of itself as a class, is simply raw material for exploitation. The process of the working class becoming a class for itself, in other words, becoming conscious of itself as a class, is the development of its own political party. This development of this political party is part of the byproduct of the class struggle. And as Engels explained, there are three fronts of the class struggle. There's the economic struggle at the workplace, there's a theoretical struggle, and then there's the political struggle. Now, in the United States, the bourgeois refers to the political system as a two-party system based on two parties, the Democratic Party and the Republican Party. If you advocate something else, you're labeled as a person who supports a third party. But I want to make this clear. We're not advocates for a third party. We are advocates for a workers' party, a party of the working class. And when a mass workers' party is established, we think it'll be the first party, and we'll let the Democrats or Republicans fight for second and third place. Now, I wanted to start with a definition that Zinoviev, the old Bolsheviks, started on how we define the class nature of a party. And Zinoviev said, "We understand by this word a political organization forming a part of any class. To put it another way, parties are proletarian and bourgeois. For us, a party is not simply a group of like-minded people or a collection of people sharing a common ideology which, irrespective of their connection with this or that class, they can preach wherever they wish. For us, a party is a part of a particular class which has arisen from its depths and has linked its fate with it." Now, this definition doesn't exclude the possibility that over time a working class party can change and degenerate. That's another question. But it should be clear that a workers' party can only be a genuine workers' party if it is independent of all bourgeois parties. It must be class independent. And a workers' party with mass support would be a mass workers' party. But in the absence of a mass party, in the United States right now, even a small workers' party would be a step forward. A small workers' party in the United States with correct policies has the potential to grow into and gain a mass base. And the establishment of a workers' party would mean that the American working class would no longer have to beg the ruling class for reforms. In other words, they wouldn't have to appeal to Congress, appeal to the president for this or that reform. But they would put the working class would put its own party forward to become a government and to reshape society. Now, the American capitalist class, they portray the United States government as a government of, by, and for the people. But a workers' party would expose this and show that it's nothing but the dictatorship of capital. It would pose an alternative. It would pose the alternative of a workers' government. Now, the question of establishing a workers' party, it's a historical necessity. It's absolutely necessary for the American working class to build its own party. And we'll have to see what specific process actually unfolds and how it brings this party about. But we know the process of establishing this party will be a combination of objective and subjective factors. Now, the ultimate historical goal of a workers' party should be to carry forward and implement the historic class interests of the working class. It should be to establish a workers' government and the socialist transformation of society. If a workers' government's established, if it doesn't transform society, it ultimately starts to function within the limits of capitalism. It tries to manage the crisis of capitalism. And that becomes a disaster, and it's not serving the historic interests of the working class. Now, although our goal is to transform society, we also agree with the fight for reforms, but we see the fight for reforms as a byproduct of the class struggle. In terms of reforms, reforms are not gained by top labor leaders chatting with the bourgeois and making backroom deals. Reforms are gained as a byproduct of the working class challenging capital, fighting capital. And in this political sphere, it would mean the establishment of an independent workers' party and the continued growth of that independent workers' party. And the bourgeois will, as they get threatened by that party, can provide some reforms to try to cut across the support that's going to that new party. But in order for that to work out, that party must continue to be class independent. It shouldn't be forming coalitions with the bourgeois parties. Now, on the left in the United States, there are three major arguments used about why a workers' party cannot really be built. One argument is that the middle class is too big in the United States. There isn't class consciousness. We need a people's party, not a workers' party. Another argument is that because of systemic racism and how it divides the working class, that will never permit the building of a united working class party. And a third argument that's put forward is American exceptionalism. The upward growth and trajectory of U.S. capitalism, how it's unaffected by any of the contradictions or problems of European capitalism, for example. Now, I want to take apart each of these arguments. First of all, this idea of the need for a people's party, that the middle class is very strong, it comes from that tradition of American populism, which was rooted in the rural farmers, the rural middle class. The social basis for populism is gone in the United States. If you go back in 1860, 53% of the labor force in the United States was involved in agriculture. So that's more than half. By 1900, 40% of the U.S. lived on farms, 40% of the population lived on farms, 60% lived in rural areas. But the massive industrialization, urbanization that's gone on from 1900 till now has transformed the United States. Now, only 1% of the United States lives on farms, and only 20% live in rural areas. Now, 145 million people are employed in non-agricultural industries, with 136 million wage and salary workers, versus only 8.8 million self-employed. Only 2.3 million people are employed in agriculture, and even that, 1.5 million of those people are wage and salary workers. They're agricultural proletariat. These corporate farms and rich farmers, they dominate agriculture in the United States. The working class predominates even in agriculture. I think these numbers show that the class balance of forces are overwhelmingly on the side of the American working class. The class consciousness of the working class today, that's another question. But there's no real social basis for populism in the next period. Now we'll take on that issue of racism. And we know that definitely racism has absolutely played a very negative role in being used by the capitalist class to divide the working class. And if a worker identifies by their race rather than their class, if they link up with their boss, they think they have more in common with their boss than their fellow worker of a different race, this ultimately weakens the working class. But we've seen over and over in history, whenever the working class struggles, it tends towards unity. It tends towards fighting against racism. Prior to the 1930s, there was a lot of racism and segregation in the American Federation of Labor Unions. But the rise of the CIO and industrial unions in the 1930s, which tended to unite black and white workers together, plus the civil rights movement in the 1950s and the 1960s, plus the Black Lives Matter movement, has all served to weaken racism. And as we saw with the George Floyd movement a few years ago, the fight against racism could actually be a catalyst that could possibly help to start the building of a workers' party. In the George Floyd movement, if there had been a wing of that leadership that had argued to set up a party against the Democrats and Republicans, It could have become a party in transition, and we would have to see how that would have evolved over time. Unfortunately, the leadership was aligned with the Democratic Party. Now, let me take up this idea of American exceptionalism, which I think we would agree is a completely false idea. It's true that since the American Revolution, and especially since the American Civil War, U.S. capitalism, U.S. imperialism was on an overall trajectory of growth. It became the world's most powerful capitalist imperialist country it is today. But it's false to say that it's exempt from the contradictions and limitations of capitalism. The Great Depression in the 1930s showed that U.S. capitalism was not exempt from the contradictions. Now, it's true, in 1939, World War II started in Europe. That pulled the economy out of the Depression. And from 1946 to 1973, U.S. capitalism had an exceptional period of the post-World War II boom. But that boom came to an end in 1973. I do recommend, though, the Comrades study the exceptional reasons why there was a post-World War II boom. Everybody should read Will There Be a Slump by Ted Grant, written, I think, in 1960. He explained the exceptional reasons for that period, but he also predicted in the midst of the boom that it would come to an end. Now, it is true that during that boom period, it did soften the class struggle in the United States, but as we said, that boom period has come to an end. And another thing I wanted to challenge on American exceptionalism is that somehow the American working class is different from all other working classes, and it will never become class conscious. It will never adopt socialism. Because I'm going to go through some historical examples where you see that's not the case, where actually the working class did try to build its own party. Just like any other working class, there are real class interests that force the working class to build its own party, but they also face the pressure from the ruling class, which tries to stop this or cut across this process. And there's always the question of the leadership of the working class, which comes under enormous pressure from the ruling class to stay within certain limits. If we study U.S. working class history, we see two tendencies develop. There were tendencies where the working class strove to build a mass socialist party and even a mass communist party. And there were also tendencies where the American working class followed the traditions of the English-speaking world, where they built trade unions first, and then the trade unions built the Labor Party. I'm going to start by looking at the Socialist Party and the Communist Party, then I'll get to the question of the Labor Party. The Socialist Party of America started out in 1901 with 7,000 members, and they were spread out over 25 states. The Socialist Party was connected with the Socialist International in Europe, founded by Engels. Just in 8 years later, the Socialist Party had grown from 7,000 members to 40,000 members, and they had grown from 25 states to 46 states. By 1918, they had grown to 81,000 members, and in 1919, after the Russian Revolution, they'd grown to 108,000 members. The Socialist Party had elected two members of Congress. One was named Meyer London from New York. Another one was Victor Berger from Milwaukee. They had many elected officials all across the United States in local government, state government. There were other elections they contested that they didn't win, but they stood and they put forward their ideas. And the perennial presidential candidate was Eugene Victor Debs, who was a supporter of the Bolshevik Revolution and a revolutionary socialist. I believe in 1912, he got his highest percentage of the vote. I think he got 6% of the vote for president. So the growth of the Socialist Party, the existence of the Socialist Party, proves that there's nothing different about the American working class, that they wouldn't necessarily be attracted to socialist ideas. But the Socialist Party did not become a mass party, and that brings up a question. Why didn't that happen? The fact is the Socialist Party had many weaknesses built into it. First of all, it was not a party that was built to take power. It was a party of protest. It attracted anybody who was attracted to the ideas of socialism, whatever flavor or tendency they happened to agree with. It was called a big tent party. It was, as Alex was explaining before yesterday, it was unprincipled unity. You had a reformist wing. You had a revolutionary wing. You had differences on all sorts of fundamental questions. For example, what is the policy of the Socialist Party to build industrial unions? Do we work in the AFL or do we work in the IWW, the Wobblies? The structure of the party, like I said, was really like a mess. That's the best way to explain it. Like, the most popular newspaper, Appeal to Reason, wasn't even controlled by the party. It was privately owned. Some of the party was based on geographic branches, like, you know, neighborhood branches, for example. But you also had these foreign language federations affiliated to the party. If you're in the Russian Federation, you're in that whole separate entity of the party. If you're a Swedish immigrant, you'd be in the Swedish Federation. A whole chunk of the party was divided on ethnic lines. This was definitely identity politics before it had the name identity politics. U.S. capitalism has always reinforced ethnic divisions as a way to keep the working class divided. The Socialist Party, by incorporating this in their structure, they were actually going along with the ideas of capitalism instead of fighting against those ideas. They didn't understand the absolute key importance of unity on class lines, across ethnicity, across race. The other thing on the question of racism, at best, there was a tendency in the Socialist Party that basically said, when we get to socialism, racism will disappear. They didn't understand that the Socialist Party should be taking a lead against Jim Crow segregation and against racism based on a program of workers' unity. And frankly, the right-wing part of the Socialist Party was even more reactionary on some of these ideas. Now, comrades, in order for a party to really build, the purpose of a party is to be able to unify and fight for a program that's going to bring the working class forward. A party should recruit, cadre, train them in theory, tactics, program, and then, of course, if there are differences, they should have a full discussion and use that to clarify those differences, to arrive at a united idea. The role of a party is to scientifically analyze perspectives, the class struggle, connect the working class with the necessary tactics and program. This must be continually checked as the actual life unfolds, as a class struggle progresses. The party's got to ask, what are the needs of the objective development of the revolutionary movement? That's what a party should do. That's what a party must do. A party should not be just a jumble of individual opinions and you try to hash things out and come to some middle agreement, some sort of temporary compromise. That won't work. You had a battle between the revolutionary socialism of Eugene Debs versus the reformism of Victor Berger. You can only keep such a thing together for a temporary period of time. Events will eventually create a split in that kind of party. Instead of having a proper discussion to elevate the theoretical level of the party and to come to some sort of accurate agreement, they avoided discussion, they avoided debate. Eugene Debs didn't want to be part of any disagreements that were going on in the party. It was inevitable that this was going to split apart. And a number of events occurred that basically bust the Socialist Party apart. World War I, the inter-imperialist war, and the Bolshevik Revolution. This inevitably leads to splits in the Socialist Party of America. In these splits, the best splits, and it wasn't one split, there was a couple, but the best splits end up forming communist parties, which eventually lead to the American Communist Party. Once these splits happen, the Socialist Party is never plays any kind of major role in the United States again. And any chance it had to develop into a mass party was gone. I do think, though, if the Socialist Party had a correct Marxist approach to theory and to organization, if they'd had principled unity, there's no question that party could have become a mass party, at least in the 1930s. But that was not to be. Now, the Communist Party also had a chance to become a mass party in the United States. In the early 1920s, the Communist Party, as I said, split out of the Socialist Party, and some of the comrades also came from the IWW. And frankly, these were bad schools in terms of teaching comrades what a correct Marxist should do. The American left, the American tradition, had been affected by the society as a whole. Trotsky explains that the theoretical level of the American bourgeois is very low because it didn't need theory to take power and to come to power and become a powerful imperialist country. They came to North America, right? They chopped down the trees, they killed the indigenous people, they enslaved Africans, fought a war of liberation against Britain. Eventually, they fought the Civil War. None of this required a high level of theory or philosophy in order for the ruling class to attain its aim. That set a standard in the United States that also pervaded the labor movement and the left. Strong strains of pragmatism and not understanding the need to study Marxist theory. The Communist Party, like I said, the early Communist Party, transferred a lot of the bad habits of the Socialist Party into its ranks. They reacted empirically to the opportunism of the Socialist Party by taking an ultra-left stand on a lot of things. Their first mistake, for example, in 1920, when they couldn't run anybody, they didn't give critical support to Eugene Debs, who was running for president from federal prison. And Eugene Debs was in prison because he had spoken against U.S. intervention in World War I, and he was a strong supporter of the Bolshevik Revolution. And if they had given him critical support, they might have been able to win him over to the Communist Party. There's a string of other mistakes as well. At first, there were also the foreign language federation formations in the Communist Party. And the leadership of the Communist Party was factionalized, or different factions constantly fighting each other. Now, Lenin and Trotsky tried their best to educate this leadership, to try to educate the cadre and to build a leadership team. But not only in the United States, but worldwide, this process was cut across by the growth of the bureaucracy in the Soviet Union. As Stalinism took over the Soviet Union, took over the Comintern, they eventually Stalinized the American Communist Party. By the end of 1928, the Communist Party in the United States was completely Stalinized. It was internally very dictatorial. But here, the irony of history is that once the Stalinists gained control, the Communist Party had a real possibility of becoming a mass party in the 1930s in the United States. But I want to make this clear. The Communist Party grew in the 1930s, not because of Stalinism, not because of their opportunist policies, but in spite of those policies. In the midst of the Great Depression and the huge trade union battles which unfolded in the 1930s, the most advanced American workers looked to the Soviet Union as a beacon. They looked to the Communist International as a beacon. So you could say a lot of the best workers joined the Communist Party, not because of their opportunism and Stalinism, but in spite of it. Now, in 1935, Stalin had the American Communist Party make an important change on a political front in the United States. The Communist Party, from its foundation in 1919 till 1935, had never supported Democrats or Republicans in politics. This changed with Stalin's Popular Front policy. Now he let the Communist Party blend itself in an opportunist manner, supporting Roosevelt, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, and the Democrats. You could say pretty much from 1935 till after World War II, with a very short exception of the Hitler-Stalin pact till Hitler invades the Soviet Union, the Communist Party functionally supported and worked through the Democratic Party. And even in World War II, they actually disbanded the party. They disbanded the Communist Party and changed their name to the Communist Political Association. After World War II, when the Cold War starts, they reestablished the party. But they had actually basically liquidated the party. Now, the growth of the Communist Party was amazing, though. From 1928, they had about 8,000 members. 10 years later, they had 100,000 members. And more important than that, the Communist Party led trade unions with about 800,000 members. That was about 20% of the CIO unions at the time. They had a real important influence in the industrial working class. There's no question if the Communist Party had been a genuine Marxist party, it could have become a mass party at that time, or it would have forced the trade union leaders to build the labor party to cut across the CP's growth. But even in that case, the Communist Party would have had an enormous amount of influence in the labor party. The fact that the Communist Party never became what it should have become is another of the casualties of Stalinism. Now, I've just gone through two examples where there could have been potentially a mass socialist party or a mass communist party in the United States. But there is another tradition, the tradition of building the trade unions and the trade unions building a labor party in the United States. I'm going to go through some historical examples. Comrades probably know about those big railroad strikes and series of strikes in 1877. After those strikes are defeated, the working class is thrown back. The working class moved on the political level. In 1878, there was a series of what they called the Greenback Labor Candidates, independent labor candidates in many different congressional and state races. In 1886, you had the great May Day rallies for the 40-hour work week, including Chicago, Haymarket. This also led to a string of labor candidates across the country in the fall of 1886. This included in New York City, where the then Central Labor Council, in August of 1886, decides to run a candidate for mayor. They run this guy, he's a socialist, Henry George, he's not a Marxist. And even though it's a last-minute campaign, he came in second place for mayor that year. The third place person, by the way, was the Republican candidate who later becomes president of the United States, a guy named Teddy Roosevelt. Now, you don't see any more real movements towards the Labor Party till after World War I. After World War I, of course, you have the Bolshevik Revolution, which is successful, and you have a series of other revolutions like the German Revolution and the Italian Revolution. Those, unfortunately, are unsuccessful. But this wave of radicalization affected the American working class. There were unionization drives of like meatpacking workers, steel workers. Some of them were successful, some of them weren't. This put a certain amount of pressure on the leadership of the labor movement. You started to have some left-wing elements in the American labor movement, particularly around the Chicago Federation of Labor, the railroad unions, etc. There's a formation of something called the Conference for Progressive Political Action. This was a confused formation. The labor leaders wanted to endorse labor candidates, but some of these people would run independently, some of them would run as Democrats, and some of them would run as Republicans. But the interesting development from this is that at some point, this splits. And the left wing starts to move into a direction of forming what they call a National Farmer Labor Party. Now, I just want to say, with the question of a farmer labor party, you cannot have a two-class party. As I said, parties are either working class or bourgeois. But you can have an organization that's in transition, where it's not clear how, in the end, is that going to be a workers' party or is it going to be something else? The early Communist Party worked in this movement for the Farmer Labor Party, and it would be correct for Marxists to work in such a formation, but we have to put forward correct ideas, correct program, and correct structure that the party really be run democratically by the working class. Otherwise, in the structure of the party, the petty bourgeois elements could predominate and outvote the workers. Now, before this national party is formed, there's a change in the situation objectively worldwide. The 1920s becomes the Roaring Twenties. A series of those revolutions that we discussed were defeated. Reaction defeated those revolutions. The Soviet Union was isolated. And that radical pressure on the labor leaders starts to recede. Some of the labor leaders that were for the National Farmer Labor Party start to pull back their support. Unfortunately, the Communist Party and didn't have a sense of proportion at that time. At what was supposed to be the founding convention of the Farmer Labor Party, they kind of packed it with more delegates than they should have had. They ended up taking over this Farmer Labor Party, but when they took it over, all they had was themselves. The important unions that were tied to it, like the railway unions and the Chicago Federation of Labor, pulled out at that point. That ended up being a stillborn project. The next movement towards the Labor Party is in the 1930s. And the first movement of the working class starts at the workplaces by building industrial unions. Major militant strikes start from 1934 to 1940. This includes the Minneapolis Teamsters, led by the Trotskyists. This includes sit-down strikes, which were plant occupations, like the Flint, Michigan sit-down strike. And you saw the amount of people in trade unions more than triples in just 6 years. There's a split in the American Federation of Labor, and a new industrial union formation, the CIO, is set up. The CIO goes from 1 million to 4 million. CIO organizes auto, steel, rubber industries. With all the success that these unions had in terms of organizing, getting the bosses to recognize their unions, capitalism was still in the midst of a severe slump. It could not provide a good standard of living for these workers. So facing being blocked on the industrial level, the working class starts to shift again to the political struggle. And there's three major developments that are steps towards the development of a labor party in the United States. First, the CIO sets up what they call the Labor Nonpartisan League. So the idea behind that was it was a step towards independent political action, but it didn't go all the way to form a party. And then there are two other developments. At that time, there was only 48 states, not 50 states in the United States. And in the mid-30s in New York State, they formed the American Labor Party.
Dans les années 1930, à New York, ils ont formé le Parti travailliste new-yorkais.
Now, that Minnesota Farmer Labor Party, as we explained, was a party that we would describe as in transition. It wasn't really a labor party, but it could have developed into one. Built into the structure of that party, it allowed cultural associations and neighborhood branches of handfuls of people to outvote the thousands of workers in the labor unions. Petty bourgeois were basically able to dominate that party. And the Stalinists had a huge amount of influence in that party. Now, to its credit, it did run candidates independent of the Democrats and Republicans, although sometimes they would, you know, not run a candidate and kind of wink at people to vote Democrat. Now, Marxists, of course, worked in that formation. Comrades have probably read Trotsky's discussions with the SWP leadership in the 30s. And we would advocate that party adopting a socialist program and adopting a structure which would allow the working class to actually democratically control that party. Unfortunately, that did not happen. And by 1944, with the Stalinist help, they took the Farmer Labor Party and merged it into the Democratic Party. And this is why only in Minnesota is the Democratic Party called the Democratic Farmer Labor Party. It's a name, but it has nothing to do with the content. In New York, the American Labor Party was established. They also ran some independent candidates, but on other lines, they would support Democrats like Franklin Delano Roosevelt or Republicans like Fiorello LaGuardia. Now, if this could have played out, if the continuation of the 1930s depression had played out, inevitably, the working class would have found a way to establish genuine labor parties. But unfortunately, in 1939, World War II starts. That changes the situation. By 1941, the U.S. is at war, and 14 million people are brought into the armed forces. All the young workers are in Europe or in Japan, you know, in Pacific. And then after World War II, you have the post-war boom, which I discussed before. And that softened the class struggle until 1973, with the world slump that occurred 73 to 76. American capitalism, since then, is on an overall trajectory, where the overall trajectory is downward. In the end, this is ultimately heating up the class struggle. And that creates the conditions in the 1990s for the rise of somebody named Tony Mazzocchi. Tony Mazzocchi was the head of the Oil, Chemical, and Atomic Workers Union, which now today is part of the Steel Workers Union. He actually supported the idea of establishing a labor party. And if any union leader wanted his members to be polled, you know, to take a poll, do they support the creation of a labor party, he would send a team over and they would poll the members. Poll after poll in the 1990s of American workers showed that they wanted a labor party. They wanted a break from the Democrats and Republicans. Unfortunately, Mazzocchi had a very mechanical approach to building a labor party. And behind this mechanical approach, frankly, was the fact that he really didn't want to fight against any of the American labor leaders who were opposed to the idea of setting up a labor party. In other words, he wants to make an omelet, but he doesn't want to break any eggs. So his idea was he set up an organization called Labor Party Advocates. Before he set this up, I should mention three events happened You had Bernie Sanders, who at that time, he had been a socialist mayor of Burlington. He actually ran as an independent for Congress, independent socialist, and he won the congressional seat in the late 80s. In Virginia, there had been a miner strike, and as a result of the miner strike, one of the local Democrats predictably had sided with the mine owners. So the United Mine Workers ran their local president, Jackie Stump, for state legislature. It was like just 3 weeks before the election, and he ran a write-in campaign. You'd have to write his name in. And he beat a 30-year Democratic incumbent. And in addition to those two things, and in addition to that, the small forces of Marxism at that time had established some contact with Mazzocchi and asked if he would, you know, work together on a project to raise the idea of a labor party. And he said he would be willing to speak at any event as long as it was sponsored by somebody of the labor movement, like a labor union local or whatever. So we got some union sponsorship to hold the meeting on a labor party in the Bay Area, in San Francisco Bay Area. Mazzocchi came to speak, and he thought he was going to meet like 10 or 20 people. But the room was like the size, like the crowd that we have today. Workers from different locals were talking about how we needed a labor party. This actually visibly affected Mazzocchi. He actually was really shocked by this. So he sets up this organization called Labor Party Advocates, and he put forward a magic formula. He said, when we get to 100,000 members of Labor Party Advocates, we'll call a founding convention. But in order to get to 100,000 members, you're only supposed to say one thing. Do you advocate a Labor Party? Yes, join this. You couldn't connect the question of the Labor Party with anything like fighting for a higher minimum wage, fighting for socialism, fighting for, you know, better. It couldn't be connected with any other issue. Just stay on the issue of the Labor Party. Predictably, in such an abstract way, it was never able to get close to 100,000, not even close to it. There were some union leaders, a few union leaders, who did endorse the idea, but it was clear that all they were doing was sending a signal to put some pressure on the Democratic Party, but they had no intention of really going all the way and building such a party. Eventually, Tony Mazzocchi gets frustrated. He's not even getting close to his 100,000 number. So he does relent, and there is a founding conference of a labor party where they actually put forward a program. But again, because he didn't want to create clashes with the labor leaders, this labor party wasn't really going to do anything. It wasn't going to run any candidates. It wasn't going to like lead protests or demonstration. There was this huge youth protests in Seattle called the Battle for Seattle in 1999. The Labor Party could have been part of that, could have taken the lead or at least participated. They stayed away. In 2000, there was talk of running a candidate against the Democrats or Republicans. Even Ralph Nader was one of those potential candidates. Ended up running too. Ralph Nader actually even said he would even run as the Labor Party candidate. Once again, stood back and did nothing. And then, of course, Mazzocchi died shortly after, and that was the end of that Labor Party. There haven't been any developments in that front since then. The American labor leadership, if anything, is even more reactionary and more to the right now than it was in those days. And it wasn't good in those days, you know. But you did see other potentials for new workers' parties being formed. It's clear that Bernie Sanders in 2016, for example, got a big echo. Bernie Sanders had broken from the Democrats and not supported Hillary Clinton. He had made a call that, you know, he's forming a socialist party. People should join, set up chapters all around the country. Party could have been formed then. Now, what would have happened to that party over time? We'd have to see. But something could have been set up at that point. But he did not do that. Unfortunately, he supported the Democrats. And as you know, as a byproduct of that, this group, the DSA, did grow in numbers. But pretty much all of their candidates run under the Democratic Party label. And so we're not surprised when three DSA congressmen vote to illegalize the railway workers' strike last fall. Looking to the future, right now it's hard to see exactly how a workers' party will arise in the United States. We know for sure that the American labor leaders are going to put the brakes on anything like a labor party, at least in the next period. You would have to have a revitalization of American labor and a complete renewal of the leadership for that to change. But we can also see movements could come forward that could start as a result, like run candidates or set up some sort of party. movements that want to challenge the Democrats and Republicans. Now, if that develops, we have to again remember that what we would intervene in would be at best something that's in transition. It's possible through a process of intervening in a transitional organization that it could develop towards a workers' party, but it might not. So what should we do today? The most important thing is to build the forces of Marxism. I can't predict what the process will be, but I can predict there will be opportunities towards a workers' party, one way or another, in the United States. And when those opportunities are posed, we want to be there to intervene. First of all, we have to intervene theoretically with the correct theory, correct program, but also numbers will matter. It's a big difference to intervene in these kind of events with 1,000 people versus 500 people. It would be even better to intervene with 5,000 people rather than 1,000 people. That's where we have to concentrate our efforts today, building the cadre of Marxism, building the forces of Marxism, constantly reviewing the perspectives and seeing what opportunities are opening up. And when opportunities open up, what is appropriate for an organization of our size to do in those opportunities. With correct ideas and correct method, you can grow over time. A small group with correct ideas and correct method can become a large group over time. And a mass party with incorrect ideas and incorrect method can disappear. Remember the Italian Communist Party in the 70s? So that's what we have to keep our eyes is on the prize, as they said in the Civil Rights Movement. The prize is to build Marxist cadre that can intervene in all sorts of situations that open up and be confident that these opportunities will arise. And at some stage, the American working class will form its party. But that party at some point must become a Marxist party. It must lead the working class to power. It must end the reign of capitalism and imperialism. It must free the world.
Thank you for listening to Fight Back Radio. Fight Back is a revolutionary organization fighting for the socialist transformation of society. We are the Canadian section of the International Marxist Tendency. We actively seek to educate workers and youth in the genuine ideas of Marxism in order to fight back against capitalist attacks and austerity and bring an end to capitalism. However, we won't be able to do this on our own. So if you agree with us, get involved. We can be found online at marxist.ca, on Twitter, Facebook, and TikTok at Canada Marxists, on Instagram at Socialist Fightback, and on YouTube as Fightback La Riposte. For international news and analysis, check out In Defense of Marxism at marxist.com. The music in this episode was General Strike by Soul Jazz Orchestra. They can be found at souljazzorchestra.com.